Florida's recount deadline of 3 p.m. today has been extended for some voters. Good morning, and thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are live from Studio 5. As just ahead, a judge's ruling throws the state's recount process into uncertainty, and it all has to do with that signature match problem. Maybe you were a voter out there who wasn't able to vote because the official at the elections office said the signature that you signed didn't match the one that they have on file. That is the issue here now. What do you think about that Florida law? What do you think about this state of the Florida recount? Give us a call right now and let us know your thoughts at 549-2937. Then later, big business news for downtown Jacksonville. Plus, StoryCorps is coming to town starting this weekend. If you have an amazing story in your family that you want to share and have be preserved forever with the Library of Congress, you need to be part of StoryCorps. We'll tell you how later in the show. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, Florida's historic recount. It's been thrown once again into uncertainty this morning. Now, keep in mind, there's a deadline of 3 p.m. today for all of the Florida counties to complete their recounts. But here's what's happening right now. A federal judge has ruled that over 4,000 voters whose mail-in and provisional ballots were rejected because their signature didn't match the one on file, well, those people are being given until Saturday at 5 o'clock to resolve the issue and have their votes counted. This decision by Judge Mark Walker of the U.S. District Court in Tallahassee came just a little bit ago ahead of this 3 p.m. deadline today for elections officials to complete their machine recount. What does this mean? Well, it's possible we could be looking at a hand recount in the too-close-to-call Senate race, where Governor Rick Scott leads Senator Bill Nelson by just about 12,000 votes. And the judge's order raises new questions about next steps in the recount in three contests overall, in addition to the Senate race, also the race for governor and the race for agriculture commissioner. Ron DeSantis, former congressman, leads Andrew Gillum, the Tallahassee mayor, in the governor's race by about 34,000 votes. And in the agriculture commissioner race, Democrat Nikki Fried is a whisker ahead of Republican Matt Caldwell. She's actually already declared victory, although that race is being recounted as well. Now, in his ruling, Walker said that the plaintiffs, the Florida Democratic Party and the Nelson campaign, have established irreparable injury to the constitutional right of citizens to cast their ballots and have them counted. Specifically, Walker noted that while the deadline to submit your mail-in ballots was 7 p.m. on Election Day, the deadline to fix a problem with a mismatched signature was 5 p.m. Monday, the day before the election. And so that's the rub, okay? That issue over the signature match. Judge Walker in his ruling is saying, in effect, that Florida's law that allows county election officials to reject a vote by mail or a provisional ballot due to a mismatched signature, he's saying that does not pass constitutional muster. And so, once again, Florida, shown before the world to be unable to effectively run an election. This is in part due to sloppiness on the part of some elections officials. It's due in part to our laws, and it's due also mainly, honestly, in part to the fact that these elections are so close. If an election isn't super close, the mail-in ballots and the provisional ballots don't matter. Now they matter. And, you know, this is where we are. And we want your calls as we bring everyone up to date on this. We'll have new information later today, but this is what's happening now to extend the deadline by two more days for thousands of Florida voters. We could be looking at a hand recount, a manual canvass in at least one of these races. Now, historically, recounts don't change the outcome of a contest, so it's still certainly quite likely that Rick Scott will be Florida's next senator, not Bill Nelson. But this is expected to extend the process now for some time. And so give us a call with your thoughts. 549-2937. Patrick is in Avondale. Hi, Patrick. Good morning.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment. Thank you for taking my call. I just think it's disgusting that in this day and age, we have to worry about somebody in our country reaching into the ballot box and taking out a valid ballot that's cast for a candidate. You have to look at who's going to benefit from denying the right to vote. Thank you.
Wait, and so do you feel that people are being improperly denied the right to vote?
Absolutely. Unquestionably, there are other problems, but when we have to be concerned about whether our vote will count when it's been properly cast, that is the most fundamental issue. Other problems are, I think, frankly, a little less important. But if we lose confidence in our ability to affect our governance, then there will be a breakdown of some monument of confidence in our own government.
Yeah, Patrick, thank you for that and those thoughts. I think you're absolutely right in the sense that if Floridians can't have confidence that their ballot is valid and that it's going to be counted properly, that is certainly undermining our entire electoral process here in the Sunshine State. And as we're learning in Florida, whether or not your ballot is counted depends a lot on the signature match, whether your signature matches the signature that's on file with the county elections offices. And that is the issue that the judge has thrown into doubt, that he's raising constitutional questions about. Theo in Atlantic Beach. Hi, Theo. Good morning.
Good morning. More just a question, Melissa. How is it that the people whose ballots have been rejected for mismatched signature, are the supervisor of elections in each of these counties somehow reaching out to them to let them know? How do they even know that they're one of the votes that have been thrown out?
I think that's why there have been so many lawsuits flying around this, Theo, both from the candidate Nelson and Andrew Gillum and the Democratic Party, and also from individual voters. They are alleging that they weren't informed in time, that they did not have a matched signature, and so they are alleging that they have been disenfranchised without their knowledge because. Apparently, what has happened sometimes is that some votes were thrown out because the signature didn't match on a mail-in ballot, for example, but the voter wasn't notified in time to fix the problem. So that's apparently at the heart of this issue. Does that answer your question? Okay.
I hadn't heard on any of the news media just how it was that they were taking steps to factually resolve the situation.
Right. And certainly different counties might have a different track record in how efficiently they're notifying voters. But that is really what seems to be shaping up to be the nub of the issue, at least for this particular recount in Florida. Who knows how many more we're going to have as the years go on. But Theo, I hope that answers your question. And we're following this, and we will continue to follow this throughout the day and the week here on 89.9. Thanks for that call. Kathy in Town Center. Hi, Kathy. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. I just have a comment. I'm an 82-year-old lady, and I have a tremor in my hands, and I'm sure there are a lot of people like me. My signature is never the same. If I, especially on those screens that they have, so if anyone has any kind of a tremor in their hand, their signature is not going to match every single time. And like
yeah.
I said, mine doesn't, and that's my only comment.
Sure. And I appreciate that, Kathy. I think that's why the issue of signature matches in the state is becoming... It has been for a while, but now with the recounts on, it's especially controversial because you're right. Your signature can change over time. And if your signature doesn't match, you have to contest that. And if you aren't even aware that it was decided that your signature didn't match, you don't know if you've been disenfranchised. You know, so what the judge is saying is that this dynamic here in the state, and by the way, we're not the only state dealing with this by any means, but that this dynamic in the state is not passing constitutional muster in terms of protecting our precious franchise, our right to vote and to have confidence that the process the state has not been applied properly, and that it's robbing voters of the chance to correct the mismatch before Election Day. Canvassing boards are supposed to notify voters immediately if they determine that a mail-in or provisional ballot has an inconsistent signature. And so the issue becomes how many voters were not notified immediately. Stephanie is in Ponte Vedra. Hey, Stephanie, how are you today?
I'm good, Melissa. How are you?
Okay, thanks. Go ahead.
I'm super concerned now because I did mail in my ballot, and I have for the last few elections, and I'm afraid that I haven't been notified. How can a voter check that their vote was actually counted?
Yes. Now, a lot of people have asked us this, and there is an easy way to do it. You go to the state's Division of Elections website. You enter your name and your birth date. You'll see a link titled Ballot and Precinct Information. You click that. And then you go to the County Supervisor of Elections website. If you're in Ponte Vedra, you could actually just Google St. John's County Supervisor of Elections website. Then you it will display your mail ballot status and whether it's been counted. So there is a process to track whether your vote was tabulated. And it's through your county's Supervisor of Elections website. But I would begin with the Division of Elections website, enter in your information, and then proceed from there to your county website. You could start at myflorida.com and then look at registration and elections. The full URL is long and involved. I can read it on the air if you want, but it's registration.elections.myflorida.com/checkvoterstatus. I know that's long and involved. But I hope that answers your question, Stephanie, because certainly voters are doing this and wondering if their vote was tabulated like you.
Yes, ma'am. I'm very concerned. I'm going to check as soon as I get to the office.
Okay. And by the way, you can go to WJCTnews.org, and we have that link on our website as well for anyone who is concerned about whether their vote was counted. If you're just tuning in, it's 549-2937. As we talk about a federal judge's ruling today, extending the recounts deadline for thousands of Florida voters who allege they were disenfranchised because they had an issue with their signature matching on a mail-in or provisional ballot. They're being given until Saturday to clear those up and make sure their votes are tabulated. A little bit more about the lawsuits. Now, just as we saw in the year 2000, lawsuits are flying in Florida, all over the place. You know, the old saying that nobody ever wins in these things, but the lawyers, well, it's basically true. As the battle over Florida's three statewide recounts rages on in the courts, with more hearings set for today, tomorrow, well, Steve Newborn explains why so many lawsuits are being filed right now by both major political parties. Take a quick listen.
The glut of lawsuits isn't new. Political scientist Susan McManus says 47 lawsuits were filed during the 2000 presidential recount, and lingering memories of that recount are foremost in the minds of current Republican and Democratic officials. In 2000, she says Democrats made the mistake of assuming that the recount legal battle would be decided in a state court, but Republicans ended up taking the case to the U.S. Supreme Court, which ruled in their favor.
So the bottom line is, from a legal perspective, both sides are keeping every legal avenue possible open until they really see where the contested ballots lie.
Lawsuits that can be expected after the recount is completed can be over things like undervotes, overvotes, too many candidates marked on a ballot, or how provisional and overseas ballots are counted. I'm Steve Newborn in Tampa.
It's 549-2937 as we discuss the latest news in the Florida recounts. A judge's ruling has thrown some of the ballots into uncertainty. He's ruling that people who had an issue with a signature mismatch and didn't get their ballots counted have been improperly disenfranchised, and they have until Saturday to correct that issue. 549-2937. Rick is in St. Augustine. Hi, Rick. Good morning.
Yes, good morning, Ms. Melissa. My concern would be, for those who doesn't have a computer, I know you gave out the website to find out if your ballot was good concerning the signature. But my concern would be, what about those who may not have a computer? I mean, like my dad, He's 89 years old, but he doesn't have access to a computer. That would be my comment.
Yeah. Yeah. And I hear your point, Rick. And I think that's why you see all of these lawsuits. Those who don't agree with the process in Florida feel that the burdens are too onerous for some voters, voters that don't have a picture ID, voters that don't have a computer or an easy way to access this information. And so that's yet another wrinkle into this process. I appreciate you sharing that because, yeah, I mean, an older person may not have a way to check to make sure that their vote was tabulated. They may never hear anything. So thank you for that, Rick. And, you know, if you go to your county's Supervisor of Elections website in Jacksonville, it's DuvalElections.com. There's a lot of information for those that do have computer access, of course, about this process and a lot of information on what to do. Say you did vote by mail and the signature that you provided on the return envelope didn't match the voter's signature on file. Maybe you've had a physical disability or a disease, so your signature changes. You were supposed to have been notified if the signature on your vote by mail or provisional ballot didn't match. And voters were supposed to be provided the opportunity to, they use the phrase, cure their ballot by no later than 5 p.m. on the day before the election. Now, the reason this new ruling from the judge has come down is because he's saying that the voters just weren't given enough time and information in time to make sure that this process was done. And so the larger question becomes, will the call grow for this signature match law to be thrown out? Will the signature match law go the way of hanging chads in the state, in other words? I think that's the larger question. Terry in Mandarin. Hi, Terry. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, go ahead.
My comments are, first of all, I believe when I voted, I actually voted in Mandarin at the library. I had to show my driver's license. I also had to sign, and they checked my signature against my driver's license. I'm sure that's how they did it. Well, the guy that's sending in an absentee ballot, he doesn't show his driver's license. One other thing, as you age, your driver's, or not your driver, but your signature changes drastically. Mine has. And I know in the workplace, and I retired from CSX, I had to sign in every morning and found out that there were people that were cheating. They'd have somebody else sign in for them. Well, the next thing they did was put up a fingerprint thing, and you had to sign in, fingerprint, go sign in on your telephone, sign in on your computer, and you had to do the same thing when you left at the end of the day because you had people that would sign out for you.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the vote is important, but I hate to tell you, if there's a cheater in the world, he might have come to America. I hate to say that.
Oh, man. Yeah, well, Terry, I hear you. Thanks for those thoughts. Yasmin is downtown. Hey, Yasmin, go ahead.
Oh, yes. I was just curious to see, why couldn't we just do the election over again? I mean, what would cause that not to happen?
You know what?
Since it can happen, right?
Yeah, I don't think that's possible legally, but I can certainly understand the sentiment because I think it's fair to say this has been a big old mess and it's not looking good.
Right. Wouldn't you think that would save our whole state money by doing that? I mean, it's just crazy.
Well, I'll tell you, the lawyer's fees are going to be extraordinary, and that's certainly not going to save money. Yasmin, it's incredible when you think about the fact that we still can't get this right 18 years after 2000. This is due to two things. One, Florida is split literally down the middle on the most razor thin of margins electorally. Yeah. And two, our elections officials have had consistent issues in certain counties in particular, getting their act together. Those are the two dynamics at work here. So that's why we're seeing this. And Yasmin, thanks for your call and your thoughts. You know, we are not the only state that's still counting ballots, by the way. There is a Senate race in Arizona that just got called because that race was so close. And so this is a function of how divided our electorate is, how razor thin the margins are between a lot of these candidates. And mail-in ballots, overseas ballots, military ballots, provisional ballots, they always would come in after the deadline. It just didn't matter before. When a race was close or not close enough that those ballots became important, it's because we are so evenly split that we're even having this conversation. Let's take one more call. It's Doran on the west side. Hi, Doran. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. I have a question for you. I'm not sure if you actually know, but I'm listening to this situation and just kind of marking through it, saying this one's a wrap. It's a mess. We'll get through it. But we need to be thinking about the future. Are you aware of what kinds of alternate technologies we can use to replace a manual signature? I really sympathize with the earlier caller who said that her signature is never the same because of her physical condition. We've got to be looking at technology and alternate to this.
Yeah, I agree. I agree, Doran. And I'm sure that that will eventually happen. Probably not fast enough for some folks. But yeah, you're right. That is an antiquated way of doing things. They are literally dealing with overheated machines right now in Palm Beach County because that's slowing down their process. I mean, this is insane. And so you're right. Technology has not been our friend this year. And lots of tweets about this. Let me just get a few of them on the air. Jay tweets the show, voter registration is a form of voter ID. That is why showing a picture ID is redundant. Josh, voters who don't have access to a computer can go to their local public library, use that computer. May, the California deadline is December 7th, if I'm not mistaken. Our arbitrary deadline in Florida is unacceptable during a midterm where millions more voted than in prior midterm elections. Take the time to properly count the votes and check signatures. Jim tweets the show, let this election be another lesson to Florida voters. Early vote, early vote, early vote. Here's one more tweet. An even bigger issue in terms of the outcome of the election is the ballot design in Broward County and the likelihood that older voters in Broward miss the Senate race there entirely. Well, certainly that's what lawyers for Senator Nelson are arguing right now in court, whether that argument is able to carry the day. We just don't know. But the latest is that some voters in Florida are being given until Saturday, 5 p.m. to cure, as they say, their mismatched signatures. Everyone else, all the other counties in the state, have a deadline of 3 o'clock today to hand in their recount results. And so updates on our newscast this afternoon on that and at WJCTnews.org. That is the latest on the recounts in Florida. In a moment, big business news for downtown Jacksonville. We'll tell you about that right after this. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Lots of business and development news happening in downtown Jacksonville. Things are popping all over, as a matter of fact. Tracking it all is David Cotton of the Jacksonville Daily Record. Hey, David.
Good morning.
You have a lot of news to share this morning, beginning with the city taking steps to prepare the shipyards project for development.
Yeah, a couple of things developed this week. City Council is going to be going over some legislation, and really what that does is it's going to rezone the whole property, this whole area over here. There's a lot of little different areas here that are all zoned differently, so the city wants to get all that the same. And that'll allow for any use of whatever Shad Khan wants to do and whatever that eventually becomes. And then also we learned this week that the city in January is going to really start ramping up, removing the ramps that are in front of us here. With
the ramps that come off the Hart Bridge. They're going to, what's going to start happening in January?
So in January, they're going to be asking, you know, contractors and development companies to submit their qualifications. Hey, can you do this project? And then about in the summertime is when we expect an RFP to go out, a formal request for proposals. For a contractor to actually do the work. And so by the end of next year, hopefully beginning into 2020, is when you'll probably start seeing that work happen.
What about funding for that?
Well, the city has $25 million, right? The city of Jacksonville put $12.5 million. The state matched that. That'll get the project done through what they, I guess, call phase one. Now, right now, the city is also competing for a federal grant that's $12.5 million to eventually widen Bay Street and sort of make it look a little bit nicer eventually. They don't need that money to start the project, though. They can go with what they have already.
Okay. We'll watch that. And in the meantime, you've also learned that Mayor Curry is asking the city's Downtown Investment Authority to pull back on plans for a new downtown convention center.
Yeah, this was sort of a surprise yesterday at the DIA's monthly board meeting. He sent a letter to Jim Bailey, who's the chairman of that board, who, you know, he told Jim, you know, basically that while this is a great project for Jacksonville, it might not be the best time. And financially, it may encumber some of the money we want to spend on some of these other public-private partnerships, i.e. Lot J, you know, other hotel projects that are popping up downtown, other development that we see coming down the pipeline. And you know, what this is, it's very interesting because all summer when this debate was going on about, oh, these new bids are coming in, all these ideas are happening, there was always that criticism of, is Jacksonville really ready for a new convention center? We don't have a lot as far as amenities downtown. There's not a just a plethora of things to do. I mean, downtown is getting better. There's more restaurants and stuff, but I don't know if it's quite where it needs to be to sustain this big hotel convention business. In a letter that he sent to Jim Bailey, you know, the mayor points that out. He goes back to that feasibility study that came out, you know, almost a couple of years ago now, that talks about Jacksonville has not quite hit the nail on the, you know, has not quite hit the hammer on the nail when it comes to amenities to support convention goers who want to come to the city, right? They don't want to just walk out on Bay Street and say, oh, well, there's a coffee shop, you know, or there's this, you know, big vacant half-built
condo.
Yeah,
not much of a wow factor, right?
Not yet.
So, okay, so if this is on hold then, let's read between the lines a little bit because, as we've all known for a while, Shad Khan would like to build a convention center as part of his overall development plans around the football stadium. And so there were two competing visions for where a new convention center would go. For those who don't know a lot about this, the current convention center is on the western edge of downtown Jacksonville at the Prime Osborne site, the old train station that's now a convention center nobody's happy with.
No, it's too small. It's kind of out in the sticks over there. I mean, I know the villa is getting a little bit more developed now, but it's not where conventions want to go. They, over the summer, the city said, hey, you know, we're going to tear down this old Duval County Courthouse, the old City Hall annex along East Bay Street.
And that's ongoing right now. That's happening as we speak.
Oh, yeah. Those buildings are coming down in January, January and February. So those are happening. You know, the city is prepping that land for whatever development could happen. I mean, it's prime waterfront property. And so over the summer, they invited contractors to bid and say, hey, give us your vision. What would you do down here? They had three respondents come in and they said, you know, gave them scores. It looked like, okay, the next step is to talk to the mayor's office and see where should we do next. In the middle of all that, Shad Khan and his Iguana Investments said, hey, by the way, if we do a convention center, this is where we would put it down here. This is what it would look like. The difference between these projects, if the city were to move on a convention center down in East Bay Street, it could probably happen within the next 18 months. Mm-hmm. They could go. Shad Khan's development is really, that's not going to happen until they remove these ramps.
The Hart Bridge, right now, back to the ramps.
That's a two-year project.
And he wants to build a really splashy, lavish convention center on the water right by the stadium.
Here's another caveat, too. Shad Khan's partners in this, Rimrock Devlin DiBartolo, that's who would build the convention center site. During this whole conversation about where to put a convention center, they offered a completely new vision for the East Bay Street location, saying, hey, well, if you can't build a convention center down there, we've got this other idea. It's a apartment complex, a new hotel, a food hall. So you don't just have this empty space there if you're not, you know, ready to build a convention center. So the timing is interesting with the mayor sending this letter, because we had this whole, media circus, I guess you could say, around the convention center. And now it seems to be, an interesting timeline.
Okay, so are you intimating then that this is the mayor's way of buying Shad Khan more time to develop his convention center proposal farther east near the football stadium, and giving these other developers space to then put up their vision on Bay Street instead?
I will say the critics are probably going to say that. I would say that the city realizes that maybe a convention center on East Bay Street is not the best option for that property, and that there are other options that may be more beneficial. Look, I don't think anybody's going to argue that there needs to be more hotels downtown. I think maybe that space is a little cramped for a convention center. And you know what? If you build more restaurants, you build more housing down there, that is better for that strip of East Bay Street.
Mm-hmm. Always good to have your insights and more in the Jacksonville Daily Record, jacksdailyrecord.com. Reporter David Cotton, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be right back.
That evening, I returned home to find my eldest brother. He was, according to my mother, the brightest, most gracious, most accomplished of all of her sons. For that reason, my brothers and I referred to him as, quote, the baby Jesus.
Join us next time for the Moth Radio Hour from the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
Saturday at noon on 89.9 WJCT.
PBS Kids Live Really Big Tiny Adventure, the new live stage show for the entire family from PBS Kids. The adventure starts as soon as you arrive with the Shrink and Explore pre-show experience. Play augmented reality games like Wild Kratts Augmented Safari. Meet favorite PBS Kids characters Arthur, Nature Cat, Super Y, and more. PBS Kids Live Really Big Tiny Adventure, presented by Zappos Adaptive, February 8th, Florida Theater. Tickets available at floridatheater.com.
Hi, this is Keith Marks. Join me every Thursday evening at 11 p.m. for Avant Radio, a show of curious music for curious minds. Each show is themed, curated, and contextualized to explore new music. Come get curious on Thursdays at 11 on 89.9 FM.
Welcome back. Well, it's one of the most common cancers in this country. It's not one of the most common cancers in this country, but pancreatic cancer is one of the most deadly. Today, November 15th is World Pancreatic Cancer Day. And it's so important to know the risks and symptoms of pancreatic cancer, because earlier diagnosis can be critical. What is on the horizon for treatment of this disease? And here's another question. Why are so many younger people getting pancreatic cancer? Here with some answers, we're pleased to welcome Dr. Michael Wallace. He's a gastroenterologist at Jacksonville's Mayo Clinic. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having me on.
Good to have you. Okay, so it's the 10th most common cancer, but the third most deadly. Why is pancreatic cancer so deadly?
Yeah, this is unfortunately a bit of a sad story. Although it's the 10th most common cancer that we diagnose, unfortunately, the survival rate is one of the lowest among all cancers. And so the survival rate or the death rate is the third most common cause of cancer death. It's really because those other more common cancers, colon, breast, skin, mm-hmm. we have better treatments and early detection for. Pancreas is something we've struggled with, although there's been some recent progress, particularly on the early detection front.
And that's key, early detection.
Absolutely. The major gains in cancer survival we've really seen in the United States and throughout the world have been both on the treatment side, better treatments, but more importantly, the early detection. You know, skin cancer, we screen for moles on the skin. Breast cancer, we have mammograms and self-breast exam. Colon cancer, we have colonoscopies. But we haven't had good screening tests until recently for pancreas cancer. So that's a major focus for us now is how do we detect it at those early curable stages?
Okay, so what are some risk factors and symptoms? Who should be screened?
So importantly, by the time you get symptoms, it's often too late. So the people that we should be screening are those that have not yet developed symptoms, but who are at risk for pancreas cancer. So that gets us to your first question, that who's at risk? What are the risk factors? The single most preventable risk factor right now is still tobacco. We've known this for 50 years. It's the most common preventable factor for all human cancers, including pancreas. But more recently, obesity has become a major risk factor. There's some news out just recently that early onset obesity, particularly in childhood, seems to be related to some of these earlier cases.
So because we have such an issue with childhood obesity, you're now seeing much younger people being diagnosed, which is so upsetting to see.
We are. And this is true for many cancers, including colorectal cancer and pancreas. You may have heard recently the guidelines changed to get your screening colonoscopy at age 45 instead of 50. We now have screening tests for pancreas cancer for those individuals who are at increased risk.
So tell me a little bit about Mayo's approach to treatment of pancreatic cancer.
So Mayo Clinic is one of the so-called comprehensive cancer centers as designated by the National Cancer Institute. It's actually North Florida's only comprehensive cancer center. And that is a special designation that means you've got a team of individuals that approach this from every possible direction. You've got gastroenterologists like myself that do early screening and detection. You've got surgeons who can do the most sophisticated operations minimally invasively. You've got very good radiology, oncology, radiation oncology, but also community support. We have wonderful community support here through groups like Champions for Hope and the Florida Pancreatic Cancer Coalition that really make a whole team approach to this.
And that is obviously why Mayo is so world-renowned. That approach is so successful. So if a patient comes to you for treatment, how do you decide if they're a good candidate, say, for surgery, and how common is that?
So our pancreas team meets every single week. We go through all of the cases that week as an entire team, the surgeons, radiologists, oncologists, and we literally sit in front of those CAT scans and MRI scans and look at is the cancer spread to other organs where it might just require chemotherapy? Is it locally advanced, maybe involving some of the nearby blood vessels, but we might be able to shrink it and get that person to surgery with some chemotherapy up front? Or is it a very early stage? Those are the ones we really hope for, where we can go directly to surgery, remove it, and hopefully cure it.
This is the kind of cancer that nobody wants to hear the words pancreatic cancer, because, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's still almost always, isn't it, a death sentence, unlike breast cancer or colon cancer or skin cancer, where if you catch them early, the survival rates are much higher. Is that too much of a stereotype to say or not?
A little bit, yes. Yeah. So the reality is about 90% of cancers that are diagnosed at late stages. So the key goal right now is to find the cancers very early before symptoms develop. We can cure among people who we get to surgery and remove the tumor. We can cure about a third of those. Whereas if you look at all comers, it's only about 1 in 10. Actually, about 9% right now are cured of all comers.
Wow. So, okay. Let me then ask you, if there's someone listening out there right now, and when they listen to these segments, they can be kind of scary, you know. Mm. I could have pancreatic cancer and I don't even know it. I have no symptoms. Yeah. Should everyone over a certain age, say, come in like just like we do for colon cancer and be screened for this? What do you recommend?
Not yet, because the two tests that have been proven to be effective for screening are a special type of an MRI scan and a procedure called an endoscopic ultrasound. And because those are somewhat invasive, they're most beneficial in those at increased risk. Fortunately, we now have identified a couple of reasons that you should think about screening. So if you have multiple family members in your family with pancreas cancer, two or more first-degree relatives, that's a mother, father, brother, or sister, or child, or three or more any relatives, you should come in and talk about getting genetic testing and screening. The second, and this is really a major breakthrough recently that was discovered at Mayo Clinic, it's called new-onset diabetes, NOD. Hmm. New-onset diabetes over the age of 50, especially if you're not obese. Most obesity in the United States now, most diabetes is related to obesity. But if you're not gaining weight and you get diabetes out of the blue, you should ask your doctor about getting screened for pancreas cancer, because that group is, that we know it occurs about 3 years before a detectable tumor. And that's really a window of opportunity for us to detect this disease at an early curable stage.
Nod. I learned a lot in this segment, but that was really something new. Thank you for that as well.
Yeah. New onset diabetes over the age of 50.
Wow. That I think is indicative of where we are health-wise as a society and what we need to be doing better. So thank you so much for this. Dr. Michael Wallace, he's a gastroenterologist at Mayo Clinic. Thanks for being here, doctor.
Thank you, Melissa.
November is Pancreatic Cancer Awareness Month. If you have those risk factors, follow his advice and get that screening in a moment. StoryCorps, you know, the thing that makes you cry like a baby every Friday in your car on the way to work. Guess what? Their mobile van is coming to Jacksonville. You can be part of StoryCorps and tell your story. We'll tell you how right after this.
Westminster St. Augustine, an active senior living community located in World Golf Village, offers residents maintenance-free living with access to golf and tennis, dining, housekeeping, and 24-hour security, plus supportive and healthcare services. More at westminstersaugustinefl.org.
A1A Solar designs and installs residential and commercial solar electric systems. NABCET certified A1A Solar provides sustainable and financially efficient energy solutions. Learn whether solar is right for you with a 5-question quiz at a1asolar.com.
For a long time, a job at an American car factory was the iconic middle-class opportunity. But on that same factory floor today,
working right there beside a legacy worker on the line, I'm doing the same identical job as he or she doing.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Same job, different pay in the temporary labor market. That's next time on Marketplace.
Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
Next time on The World, the British voted to leave the European Union. That was 2.5 years ago. They've been fighting over how to do it ever since. And regardless of how it plays out now, no one expects to be happy. Brexit Revealed, plus a chatter in Washington about Saudi Arabia, and some unexpected stories from around the globe. Surprises, good ones. Join us. It's On the World. This afternoon at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
Last year, the White House's Opioid Commission delivered 56 recommendations to rein in what it calls the crisis next door. Bills have been passed, and new data suggests the tide might be turning. Still, more than 115 Americans die from overdoses every day. What's changed, and what has not? Next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Since 2003, StoryCorps has collected more than 60,000 interviews with over 100,000 participants from all backgrounds. People come to StoryCorps to record an interview with someone they love, and those recordings are archived at the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress so that future generations can hear the stories and the voices of today. StoryCorps is America's oral history project, and what better way to listen to America than from the road? In 2005, we converted an Airstream trailer into our traveling recording studio, our mobile booth, and launched our first cross-country tour. It's a road trip that's been going on for more than 10 years. Each year, we visit places across the country to record the stories of people who live there. We partner with local public radio stations, cultural institutions, and community-based organizations to get the word out and invite people to bring someone to the mobile booth. Our trained StoryCorps facilitators help set the scene for 40 minutes of uninterrupted, meaningful conversation between friends and loved ones. Life on the road means that we get to visit some extraordinary places and meet extraordinary people. And when the visit is done, we say goodbye, pack up the mobile booth, get on the road, and head to our next destination.
And you've been listening to the people behind StoryCorps. Yes, the famed Oral History Project is coming to Jacksonville this Sunday. If you've ever listened to StoryCorps on 89.9 on Fridays during Morning Edition and just cried your eyes out, guess what? Now it's your turn to not just listen, but to tell your story, your family story, your personal story. The StoryCorps people are coming to Memorial Park in Riverside starting this Sunday. And our own grants and education outreach manager, Cersei Lenoble, is in the middle of all of this and has a lot of information that we need to hear right now. Hey, Cersei, good morning.
Good morning.
This is so exciting.
It is very exciting. The Airstream actually arrived yesterday.
It's sitting at the park now.
It's sitting at the park now. It's at Memorial Park next to the river. And so the people with StoryCorps are super excited to be in such a great location. And so we're excited for people to start signing up.
So how can people be part of this?
The easiest way, wjct.org/StoryCorps, and that's C-O-R-P-S. You can go there, find out information. They are here. They start on Sunday, but they are recording until December 21st. There are slots that you sign up for online. You can also get information about tips for doing the conversation, questions to ask, all kinds of great stuff.
And are there still slots available?
There are still slots available. And right now, slots are only available for the first half of their visit. But on November 20th, you can go back to their website and sign up for slots for the rest of their visit.
And to be clear, anyone that wants to tell their story or have their conversation can do it. You don't have to have a big dramatic story, right?
No. Yeah. I mean, exactly. And that's the message I want to make sure everybody understands. You don't have to have something that you think is important to say. It's really just about a conversation with two people. They can be coworkers, they can be related, they can be mentor-mentee. It can be anything. It can run the gamut. I'm looking at, right now, my grandmother and my mother live with us, so I'm going to talk to them and see if I could do all of us, including my daughter. So four generations, and I don't know what we're going to talk about, but I'm sure, you know, something important is going to come out of that, even if it's just a conversation with the four of us that, you know, in perpetuity, we can go back and listen to.
Yeah. Just hearing you describe that, I feel tears coming up in my eyes because my grandmothers are gone. My mother's gone. You know.
Exactly. And
you're going to capture that while they're still here.
Yeah. And take that opportunity. And I think that's an important thing for people to realize. And there are lots of people who we've heard from. Some lady called and said that she, last time StoryCorps was here, she recorded a story with her mother, and her mother's no longer here. And it wasn't this important life-changing topic. It was just a conversation.
Right. And the power of these conversations, I just don't think it's possible to overstate the impact that they've had.
Oh, and like you said, I can't listen to StoryCorps on Friday mornings without just bawling. And even when I talk about, like, one of my favorite stories is from 9/11 and a firefighter who, he was a father who talked to both sons before they went. They were both first responders. And so I, just talking about it, I get chills and I get teary. And and it really is impactful. And this is the largest, one of the largest collections of oral histories in the world. And it's just an important time, even if you don't think you have something important to say, to take this opportunity.
One thing we've learned is that everyone has a good story. And
they do.
This is proof of that. And we're going to have a listening party here at WJCT as well.
We are on December 13th here at WJCT Studios. We're going to get to listen to some of the stories that have been collected in Jacksonville and find out about how StoryCorps works and some of the stories they've discovered as well.
So just do as Cersei says, go to wjct.org/StoryCorps. And that's C-O-R-P-S. And sign up to record your story. And go check out the mobile recording booth. It's up there now at Memorial Park in Riverside. Cersei, thanks for sharing all this.
Thank you.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening. 1A is up next. I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.